Well, good evening and good morning, EPL State of Mind listeners. We've got an action-packed episode for you this week, including Man City snatching victory at the death in dramatic fashion yet again to save points, while Arsenal's unbeaten run comes to an end after William Saliba's red card. Tottenham put on a dominant display, reminding everyone that they could be a force to be reckoned with this season, competing in the top four position. Finally, a heated clash between Liverpool and Chelsea had tempers flaring and fans on the edge of their seats till the end. Let's dive into all the action. I know you have missed us. Myself, Kyle, and Sean are magical, magisterial voices over the past few weeks. Life came at us all relatively fast. I have started a new job on Monday. Sean is nearing parenthood. Kyle is busy at work as per usual and just being Kyle Mansley. That takes a lot of energy, probably just to wake up every day for you.
Dude, it's a lot. It's a lot. Yeah.
I can't knock you there. But boys, welcome back. Happy to see you guys. How are you doing? Sean, nearing parentinghood. How are you doing? Have you gone absolutely crazy yet?
No, it's good, man. I'm happy to do this. It's been a long hiatus. I think this is the longest we've gone off other than the off season. So happy to be back and talking footy with you fellas.
Has the crib been built in
it? It was built this weekend. Saturday. I said, hey, we got to get this done Saturday. It's not happening. I told Grace way ahead of time. Chelsea, 11:30, don't talk to me, don't look at me, don't even be in the house. I was like, go get a massage for 80 minutes and then drive around for another 10 after that because you're getting zero attention from me. So after that, I'll be the dutiful husband. In between, absolutely not.
That's it. That's it. You have to have priorities. There are responsibilities. I heard a rumor that there is the you'll never crawl alone mural on the wall in the nursery. Is this true?
Yeah, I can either confirm or deny.
Kyle, how are you, my friend? I know you have a holiday or a business dinner tonight, so we are blessed with your presence for a little bit here.
It's true. I'm actually recording from the office today. Bought all the stuff with me. It's going to be a lot of fun. But other than that, solid weekend, solid week. I lost my 60-degree wedge on the golf course. Very upset about it. That's really it. Yeah, big week. Big week.
Again, a lot of energy from you, my friend. I love it. Well, we apologize deeply. Like Sean said, we were on a bit of a hiatus there, but without further ado, we'll get into our regular scheduled programming here. I know it's not on a Monday we're recording. We had some more life events happen yesterday. So Tuesday we're recording today, but we're always going to stop off with some hot news and the gaffer king himself with an update here. Sean, it's Thomas Tuchel being hired as England's final selection for manager.
Yes, he takes over for Gareth Southgate, and it's a huge win for me. He's an elite knockout competition manager. Obviously, he won the Champions League at Chelsea, got PSG to a Champions League final. He's known for being a really strong defensive coach with either a back three or a back five. He's great on the counterattack, which should play into the hands of a lot of the attacking players that they have. It just kind of will be interesting if he does go with that back five, who actually makes, you know, the midfield and the attack, because they have so many options between Saka, Palmer, Rashford, Anthony Gordon, Ollie Watkins, Harry Kane, Bellingham, Foden. I probably missed a few
the list
there
goes
as well.
On.
Yeah, so it really does. Will be interesting. A lot of competition for places. The blowback from English fans saying, you know, how can we hire a German manager? It boggles my mind because you just went from a manager that almost nobody rated, that played very dull, boring football. Going from Southgate to Tuchel is like going from the mother in How I Met Your Mother to Margot Robbie, which Jordan Belfort does in The Wolf of Wall Street. That's literally the upgrade. That's the level of upgrade we're talking here. No disrespect to the mother, but let's just be real here.
Absolutely. I mean, we've kind of seen this before when you saw Chelsea, right? That Thomas Tuchel is from Chelsea. You look at, I would almost consider it a similar situation as when we had who the hell was it? Why is the name escaping from me right now? But the Brighton coach, when he went to Chelsea, I almost considered him.
Potter.
Thank you, Potter. Potter, to me, is interchangeable with Southgate. Didn't really have any credibility. He did a good job at Brighton. Maybe Southgate did a decent job early on with England. But when he gets all these massive players, which you listed the talent that England has, couldn't do anything with them. Tuchel is no stranger to world-class players, so I'm excited to see what he's able to do with them.
Yeah, and just I would say his number one achievement is being partly responsible for giving Kyle Mansley maybe the dumbest tattoo in the history of all tattoos when he got a Champions League. What would you call it? The ball, ball on his arm, the ball. On his arm with the year on it, and then they lost. So
hey, man. Well, there is no year underneath that Champions ball. Absolutely
not anymore. Okay, well, so it was a dumb tattoo. Was it a dumb tattoo? Yes or no?
In hindsight,
okay. Yep. All right. Silence is deafening.
But now that we've got one, you know, it's the smartest tattoo of all time.
Preemptive celebration will get you nowhere, but eventually it was doomed.
The $1,000 I lost on that game too was nothing compared to this tattoo being stuck on my body after that loss.
It's all right. It will live with you forever in infamy. Well, talking about infamy and trying to segue to that Champions League tattoo, we had more rounds of Champions League football today, and we are going to be blessed with more tomorrow as well. Unfortunately, today at work, I was not able to watch the Gunners play, but we did have a 1-0 victory, a little bit of a bounce back from the upset over Bournemouth this weekend. You know, thank you to Shakhtar Donetsk with helping us dodge. You might remember them during that saga. Dodge a bullet, a 70 million size bullet. That is Mykhailo Mudryk. That is the team where he was traded from Chelsea. So that was a 1-0 victory. One thing to notice here is we did not physically score a goal. Martinelli caused an own goal. And then Leandro Trossard missed the penalty kick late in the second half to seal the deal. But we squeaked away with 1-0. As it stands, prior to the match, Arsenal were sitting at 13th on the table. And Shakhtar was at 27th. Obviously, we won't do an update till tomorrow with the remainder of the teams. Another really exciting rematch happened today, and that was the rematch of the Champions League final last season with Real Madrid, who was sitting at 17th on the table at the time, versus Dortmund, who was sitting at 1 on the table at the time. This was at the Bernabeu, and Madrid went down 2-0 going into the second half, and Dortmund maintained a 2-0 lead within, like, I think, until the 60th minute, where all hell broke loose, and Real Madrid created 5 unanswered goals. So a 5-2 win for Real Madrid there, keeping it within the EPL state of mind, English Premier League family. Villa, the tournament genius and mastermind Unai Emery, faced a winless Bologna and continued the winless streak for Bologna with a 2-0 victory at Villa Park. A team that is seriously grooving in the Champions League so far with, I believe, 3 wins out of 3. So keep an eye on Villa. They are definitely cruising tournament style as usual, for Unai Emery. As far as games tomorrow, Kyle, why don't you highlight the two that we have here? Some really exciting ones, of course, and then one really interesting one because of Sean, your history with the club, and obviously Jurgen Klopp's history of the club.
Yeah, I mean, we'll dive right in. Piggybacking on your Aston Villa take there, we got a little bit of Bayern Munich versus Barcelona. Personally, I think this is going to be the best game of the week, if not, you know, Dortmund-Real Madrid was awesome. That's the finals rematched, but this is coming off of a big loss for Bayern Munich against Aston Villa. As James said, Bayern Munich is not a team that tends to lose in the Champions League group stages. This is their first loss in about 7 years in group stages. And Barcelona have been playing phenomenal football as of late, in my opinion. They've been clicking on almost all cylinders. They've been winning matches, and they are dominating the La Liga right now over there in Spain. So I think this is going to be a little bit of a revenge game for Bayern Munich. I think they're going to come back and attack. And it'll be interesting seeing Lewandowski going against the defense that backed them up for so many years. So I think it'll be a phenomenal game to watch. But, you know, going off what you said as well with Sean, we've got Liverpool versus RB's Leipzig. This is interesting because Jurgen Klopp, the old manager for Liverpool, for those who, you know, live under a rock, this is one of his new teams, since he is now the Red Bull's new head of global soccer, and he's going up against potentially his favorite club. So this would be slightly more interesting if the game was at Anfield, as Sean noted here, just to see if Klopp actually comes, because he's not like the head coach. He's not standing there on the sidelines, but he's an integral part of football and his mind is priceless. So it would just be one of those moments of, hey, get your ass behind the dugout and watch the game. You know, we might be leaning our head toward you, whispering in our ear, something like that. But I'm looking forward to it. That should be another good one. I think Liverpool takes this win, even though Klopp knows them inside and out. Sean, do you have anything to add on that one?
No, not really. I think you kind of hit everything. It'd be cool if he would be there and just to reconnect with some of the players and meet the beautiful bald bastard that is Arne Slot. but no, don't really have anything else. I think it'll be a good game for sure, though. Two very similar styles.
Yeah. Is it going back to the Barcelona Bayern Munich game real quick? Is this Lewandowski's first game against Bayern Munich since the transfer? Does anyone know that off the? I think it is, right? Yeah. All right. Very cool. Well, two great games tomorrow. Barcelona currently sitting 16th in the table, while Bayern Munich is sitting 15th. So first place in their respective leagues and neck and neck on the Champions League table. And then RB Leipzig sitting at 29th place, while Liverpool is cruising through the Champions League as per usual at 5th place. All right. Exciting to always have midweek games back in action, but we live for the weekends. We live for the EPL Saturdays and Sunday mornings. And this weekend, I rather not have. And it was with a return that we waited for so long, with the damn a second international break that we're all tired of. And I longed and longed for a Arsenal win against a lesser team. And I just wanted to watch happily. And I couldn't even get through 31 minutes with a smile on my face for this one, as Arsenal were upset heavily by Bournemouth 2-0 at Vitality Stadium. Now, before, Sean, I hand it over to you, I will say up front, first things first, we do have to give Bournemouth credit where credit is due. For the first 20, even 30 minutes before we reduced to the 10 men, Arsenal couldn't really gather possession. We looked like a 2019, 2018 Arsenal. We weren't able to string more than maybe three passes together. Even when we did, it didn't result in anything. We weren't able to hold on to it like we usually do for the past couple of seasons. Bournemouth had great coverage, 2-3 men pressing ball every second ball slash pass. So I do think, you know, we ran into a lot of troubles there. Do I think we could have still won the game at the beginning when we were down to 10 men? Yes, but obviously we know what happened, and I'll let you kind of guide us through that conversation.
Yeah, like you said, I think they started the game well from a Bournemouth perspective. Probably was played at the tempo that they wanted to play. Arsenal wasn't necessarily super composed on the ball. They didn't have their most technically gifted players available, with Odegaard and Saka absent. But obviously the turning point in the match is the 31st minute, as you mentioned. Leandro Trossard plays a kind of a loose back pass towards his own goal in the direction of William Saliba. Evan Nielsen runs in behind and Saliba pulls him down. Initially, the official Rob Jones calls that a yellow card. And then after VAR review, it is judged to be a denial of an obvious goal-scoring opportunity, which results in an automatic red card and a one-game suspension for Saliba. So I'm going to treat this like a court case. I'm going to lay out all the facts. I'll be the prosecution here. And obviously, shockingly, James is going to act as the defense. There's four pieces that you need for denial of an obvious goal-scoring opportunity. And Gab Marcotti, who I don't ever recommend listening to ESPN, because I think they're usually pretty stupid and they have pretty bad takes when it comes to football. However, he had a good article where he kind of broke everything down. The first piece is the distance between the attacker and the goal. He's inside the semicircle. That one's far out. So then that makes the next 3 points extremely important and have to be very clear. The general direction of play is the second piece. The ball is played back towards the Arsenal goal in the center of the pitch. The third piece is the likelihood of keeping or gaining control of the ball. Now, James is going to tell you that Saliba is in the equation here. However, according to the rule, the fouling player is not factored in there. So let's pretend that Saliba is not there. The odds of Evan Nielsen gaining control of the ball are exceptionally high. He's in the center of the pitch. There's really no coverage around him. And this brings me to the last piece, which is the location and the number of defenders. David Raya, and I think this is what I didn't even necessarily know this rule, but they mentioned it on the broadcast. David Raya went backwards, and they were showing the play from that angle. That basically was the deciding factor, because Ben White is the furthest non-Saliba defender back, and he's on the other side of the pitch. So if Raya comes out to sweep, then he probably stays on. But because Raya retreats towards his own goal, this is considered to be denial of an obvious goal-scoring opportunity. Evan Nielsen's going to run in behind unless he falls flat on his face, but he's not Daniel Jones. He's Evan Nielsen, so he probably stays up and gets a shot off. Hey, I'm a Jets fan. I'm hurting too. I had to take my swipe when I could. So my only beef, and I think the only beef you can have as an Arsenal fan for this one, is that it's not necessarily a clear and obvious error. And that's the definition of VAR and what qualifies for an overturn. But I think this is the one that should, I don't think it will, but it should have the least amount of complaints from Arsenal fans and our beautiful friend James here. So I'll turn the floor back over to you and the prosecution rests their case.
Well, thank you, Sean. It's an honor to be standing here in the courtroom with you, and your history here has been tremendous for the community. I will like to agree with you that of all the three offenses, done to Arsenal Football Club, I would say this is definitely the least argumentative one. I think the other two regarding the time wasting is very more subjective into the sense that why did we have those issues happen? So less arguments for this one, but I would agree and harp on the fact that your point of contention, whether this was a clear and obvious error that required VAR's intervention, would be kind of my main sticking point here. Getting into your four-pronged approach or Gab Marotti's, what he mentioned about the distance, the general direction, the likelihood, and location, just based off of my previous experience as a player, I get to say I got paid slightly for a short amount of time as an athlete in college, that I'm going to harp on two things. One, the distance between the attacker and the goal. This is just too far to create any obvious goal-scoring opportunity, specifically one that makes it that the ref on the field's decision of yellow card is not proper and needs to be reviewed again. His first touch by Saliba, which, by the way, I won't even bring it up more than this, but it's very faint. It's around the left-hand shoulder. It's a classic move by all defenders. They just touch him to get him thrown off a little bit. Obviously, a forward is going to make the most of it, as which he should have done and led to what we do. But I still think the contact is very minimal there from Saliba. The general direction of play of the ball, it is towards the goal. I have no defense there. I agree with that. As far as the likelihood of keeping or gaining, I did not know that the foulee or the player that committed the foul is not to be considered in the equation. But now I do know that is absolutely special, because there is no way that you cannot factor in that player. If he doesn't commit the foul, how is that not a part of the factor? We've known Saliba's speed. We know he's able to track back. And even not, let's look back at a couple too obvious opportunities. Let's look at last season where Heung-min Son was straight in on goal. He got the ball probably around the 30-yard mark. He goes one-on-one with Ederson. The dude shot it straight at Ederson. So this style of an opportunity is a very, very difficult goal for a forward of Son's quality, or as big as the phony and the fraud of Calvert-Lewin earlier this season, had all the time in the world one-on-one with the keeper from a similar run that he was just slightly onside. And he took so long that the center back, who let's say would have been Saliba in this situation, who was even further away, was able to track back and block a shot. So Saliba being one of the league's best center backs, I do not think that point number three, the likelihood of keeping or gaining the control, is in fact a reasonable point to hang your hat on. I think as part of the defendant, my job is to put reasonable doubt into your mind, and I think that's reasonable doubt.
Yeah, except here's the thing. You should be asking the question not to VAR. You should be asking William Saliba why he's pulling a guy down if he's going to be the person that's chasing somebody in behind, if he's so incredibly fast and composed. Kyle.
Yeah, I mean, I also just wanted to elaborate on one quick point. I had the pleasure of watching the game with James at a bar. And after a couple Guinnesses, James did look at me right afterwards and go, "That is nonsense. There's only one player in the league that scores that every time." James, you want to elaborate on that a little bit?
It's Haaland. So the biggest, and you're right, I said it. And as soon as they went to the VR screen, I also stood up, walked 15 feet down the bar and just screamed my mind off. But that's a very difficult shot. I've been in that position personally. And when you have too much time to think, it's a very difficult shot. It's a different, difficult attack. And then, of course, anytime a center back is on your back, it's going to be difficult. But the rule is not a clear goal. It's a clear goal scoring opportunity, which this could be and is fairly put underneath. I still think it's soft. I think that it's not, like Sean mentioned before, an obvious error from the referee at the beginning to receive that yellow card. But I still think that's absolutely ludicrous that you would consider Saliba out. Now, to your point, Sean, before about the composure of Saliba, the question really goes up one further, and you got to question Trossard of that loose back pass.
Fair.
He sees the field in the direction that he is going to. So you got to kind of be like, were you trying to pass it to the 50-yard line or were you trying to get all the way back to Raya? Kind of put us in this unfortunate situation. And for Saliba, it's an instinctual 2 seconds. He's probably thinking there's got to be someone covering slightly behind me who's going to get there. He does what he does. I think it's still very little contact that Bournemouth made the most out of, which is why it resulted in the red card. I think if he's, you know, we've seen this before with Saliba and Haaland where they're going body to body. It's a similar going towards our own goal. And the referee calls it as going at each other, very 50-50. I think it's such a light touch and such a sell that's what causes this controversy here. Other than that, I can't complain. If I'm going to pick which ones to complain about, I'll complain about the Brighton and the Man City game more. I think those are a bit unjust. Real quick, yes and no. Does Arsenal have a discipline problem? No, we don't have a discipline problem. Yes, do the silly red cards have to stop? Yes, but we do not have a discipline problem. When you look at when Arteta inherited Arsenal, that was a team with discipline issues. This team right now is not in the same ballpark as that. So I think they'll be able to turn around. And unfortunately, this one was something that Saliba's never done in his entire career, and he's been red carded. But yeah, it is what it is. We move on.
Yeah, absolutely. And just, again, to give Bournemouth some love before we drop this one, have to give a shout-out to Justin Kluivert for a really nice piece of skill on the corner kick. Obviously, it helped that there was one less Arsenal defender in the box, which set up Ryan Christie to give them the lead. And then Evan Nielsen, again, was a thorn in Arsenal's side. He pounced on another bad back pass from Kiwior that was kind of an in-between no-man's-land pass between himself and Raya. Evan Nielsen went on it, went around Raya, and then Raya took him down, which set up Justin Kluivert for the game-sealing penalty and gives Arsenal only their second loss in 2024 and their first away loss in 2024. So brings an end to a very, very impressive run of games for the Gunners.
Yep.
It's also just staggering how far Bournemouth has come these couple of years.
You were the first person I thought of when that red card happened. I was like, I know Kyle and James are watching this game. And Kyle's like probably like a little bit psyched that Arsenal's probably going to drop points, but also like to Bournemouth of all people, my hated rivals.
Yeah. The damn cherries. But moving on to one of my other hated rivals here is Tottenham 4, West Ham 1. Now, I believe West Ham scored the first goal of this match, and then Tottenham revitalized themselves, especially from last week. But Kyle, do you want to talk briefly about this goal, you know, XGs and you know, what we were really expecting and the turnaround for Tottenham?
Yeah, no, absolutely. West Ham got off to a great start. They started with high pressure, and they were able to score one very quickly against Spurs, who didn't look to be that good or that aggressive throughout the game. I was able to watch a little bit of it. But I got to tell you, when you got players of Son's caliber and they start catching fire, watch out. I mean, he was slicing and dicing. His goal, it was, I don't want to say a garbage time goal. It absolutely was not. It was in like the 70th minute, but it was for the fourth goal. It was like a Ronaldo triple step over, left foot strike, low and hard. It was phenomenal. Absolute a clinic on how you take on a one-on-one defender and roast him and put him on a highlight reel. Other than that, Son absolutely caused the third goal, which was another own goal from West Ham. But all in all, I don't think this scoreline really shows the quality of the play. The XGs was 0.98 to 2.21. Nothing too crazy there that would lead to a three-goal walloping. But just talking about the game a little bit, the EastEnders opened the scoring with a beautiful cutback by Jarrod Bowen and Mohamed Kudus, who has just been electric as of late. And then from there, Tottenham just dominated the game. Kulusevski, Bissouma, and Son all got on the score sheet. Son should have been on there twice. It was an own goal, unfortunately. Ball came right back off the goalkeeper, hit the defender, and went straight back into the net. Nothing the defender could do. It goes down as an own goal on him, if I'm not mistaken. It's the first one he's ever had. And it's just unfortunate positioning. Nothing he did wrong, just a goalie clearance up the middle instead of to the side. There's also a Donnybrook late in the game between Van de Ven and Kudus, which resulted in Kudus being sent off for violent conduct. And I mean, we've talked on this podcast before about my boy Richarlison, this motherfucker. He should be in the Olympic diving team. It was insane. It was perfect. Just a clinic on how you bitch and moan and then pop right the hell back up. I hate the man. It's don't get me started on it.
The fact that it was with his, if you haven't seen it, Mohamed Kudus decides to go hand Mortal Kombat to everybody around him like he's the Hamburger Helper, just slapping faces everywhere. And then, of course, Richarlison, who has been on the field for 5 minutes, comes over to the commotion. Someone backs into him. He just goes on the ground. So at one point, you saw a sniped Vandervint and a sniped Richarlison on the floor. And that's what gives soccer a divey kind of name, but absolutely unbelievable. And Kyle, how much of a major blow is this for West Ham losing Kudus for, I believe, since it's violent conduct, it is a 3-game suspension. Yeah. And originally, this was a yellow card. VAR took a look at it, realized he slapped two people, said, no, this is straight red. You're gone and you're out for 3 games. How much of a loss is this going to be for West Ham, who's already struggling?
I think it's big. I mean, the next 3 games they have aren't going to be the hardest 3 games of the season by any means for them. It's United, Nottingham, and Everton. And in my opinion, I think this is going to be most impactful against Nottingham Forest. I think they're the most informed team out of those three. United did scrape up a win, but it was at home and not for nothing. They should have had 4 or 5 goals that game. They looked good. They missed a lot of big chances. And Everton, it's Everton, but I got to tell you, Nottingham looks good right now. They're coming off a win at Crystal Palace this week, and it's going to be a big blow, in my opinion, James. I really think it is, because those are games that, you look at the schedule as West Ham, and you see United, Nottingham, and Everton. In the beginning of the season, you circle those 3 games as, the majority of a month where you expect to win. You expect to go up in the rankings, not down. That should be, realistically, you should be targeting 4 to 6 points out of those 3 games as a club of that caliber. And without Kudus, I think you're getting by with draws. Maybe you snake out a win on one of them, but I think it's a big hit.
Yeah. I mean, they're sitting down right now in 15th place for them right now, which is not ideal. And Kudus, to me, right now is probably their highest rated player for them in creativity and goal scoring opportunity. He was a great player last year, so I think it's a huge loss. Sean, on the other side of this coin, if you're a Spurs fan, how much of a relief is this for you after coming off of a major loss against Brighton the week prior?
Right, yeah, obviously it's a huge bounce back. I think Ange talked about how painful it was for him to lose that game and then have to go into the international break and sit. They played well in that Brighton game too, and it just kind of was like a 20-minute stretch where Brighton just took over and scored goals, but they were probably the better team on the balance of the 90 minutes. They were definitely the better team on the balance of 90 minutes in this one, and definitely some positive signs from them. No one in the Premier League has created more expected goals than Spurs so far this season, and they also have 6 players with multiple goals so far. And one of them, and Richarlison is not one of them. So they kind of goal scoring by committee. Kulusevski looked really good in the 10, and something that you highlighted here, a big piece of this was the tactical change by Ange to take James Maddison off at halftime with Pop Sarr coming into that double pivot role and then pushing Kulusevski into the 10. It really worked off. It was like you said, a high risk, high reward move, but it paid off with a goal. I think Kulusevski's been probably their best player this year besides, maybe Van de Ven. I think he's really looked strong, and I think he's came into the league as a winger, but it's clear now that he's a midfielder.
Yeah, I think Kulu, from his loan from Juventus, has been one of Spurs' most consistent players, and I think he's always going to be fully developed. So well done for Spurs for even getting that obligation to buy at a discount from Juventus for them. So we've highlighted that before. But another team that deserves a little bit of kudos here this weekend was Liverpool 2, Chelsea 1 at Anfield.
Nice to down there, James. A little bit of kudos. That was nice. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Some of them go under the radar, but I appreciate every once in a while. But Sean, your boys, definitely not the most, easiest game to watch as terms of coasting to a victory against Chelsea, who you guys have dominated Anfield over the past couple of seasons, I believe. So why don't you take us through this? And it was pretty evenly matched. At one point it was 1-1. Some, more risky or controversial refereeing in this one, I know you'll highlight as well, but take us through the flows and valleys on this one.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, like you said, it was a very evenly matched game. I was pretty impressed with how Chelsea played. I haven't really got to see too much of them since they played City the first game of the season. I know the results have been good, but yeah, obviously the process there is headed in the right direction under Maresca. I think they controlled the play a lot in terms of possession. Gusto in particular, I thought was pretty good. But yeah, for a large portion of this game, it was really cagey because I think the managers approached the game in a very similar way. They press, but they want to be controlled in how they press. They're not just going to, you know, the classic Liverpool, you know, gung-ho approach under Klopp has kind of changed. They're a little bit more controlled and balanced in how they approach things. But even still, I thought Caicedo and Lavia early in this game were really, really impressive. You know, obviously, I thought they were taking the piss a little bit, putting both of them in the lineup because they were two guys who were heavily linked to Liverpool at the beginning of last season, and then obviously both signed for Chelsea. But yeah, they were really impressive. I thought they were, you know, able to fend off Liverpool's press with pretty good ease. Reece James obviously was a boost for them. He's making his first start since December of 2023. So from that perspective, everything kind of started well for Chelsea. But I think the two guys that really stood out in this game from a Liverpool perspective were the guy who won the penalty in Curtis Jones, and then Mohamed Salah, who scored that penalty for, I think he's somewhere like 162 goals or something like that in the Premier League. I mean, he's one assist away from Thierry Henry and like 13 goals. He's just an absolute legend of the game now at this point. Yeah. And speaking of, how does he not win a yellow card against Levi Colwell in this game? It's actually beyond me. Early in, right, probably 5 minutes before the penalty, Salah gets the ball on the right wing. Colwell tries to mug him, needs to hit the weight room, falls down, then does that scissor tackle where you take your each leg and wrap it around the guy's leg. Salah stumbles but stays up. The referee gives advantage. Play goes on. Colwell then bodies Salah, knocks him over from behind. I think he was definitely, you know, looking for the penalty. No doubt about it, because we just saw that he was way stronger than Colwell. Mm-hmm. But that's fine. You play advantage. How do you not pull the game back later, though, and give Levi Colwell a yellow card? It's actually mind-boggling. John Brooks was horrendous in this game. There's probably my favorite meme of the season so far is Darwin Nunez and Arne Slot's reaction when there's a late 50-50, probably into stoppage time, and Nunez just shoulder barges a guy, like pretty standard behavior, just wins the ball back, and then there's a foul. And Slot's head, you can see his head just explode. Like, he just was just enraged. And he's the guy who's been, for the first eight or nine games of his tenure, however many he's coached now, he's been pretty level-headed and cool, like kind of the antithesis of Klopp in a lot of ways. He was like, his head was on Mars. He was like, this is fucking bullshit. So that was great. I thought that was funny. It was cool to kind of see him show a little bit of fire. And this game certainly had what Kyle likes to see as well. 7 yellow cards in total. No one has been yellow carded more than Chelsea this season with 30. They have 4 more in the next closest competition. But yeah, I mean, really good game overall. Like you said, Chelsea did get one back right after halftime with Nicholas Jackson scoring a really nice goal off a pass from Caicedo, who again was very, very impressive. But that only lasted 3 minutes when Curtis Jones got on the end of a Mo Salah cross and was able to chip it past Robert Sanchez. It gives Salah 34 games with a goal and an assist in the Premier League. He needs just one more game of that type to have a piece of the record with Wayne Rooney. But yeah, overall, Liverpool was able to hang on from there. I think Chelsea was good. Like I said, they controlled the game from a possession standpoint. But I think we were deserved winners because other than that Jackson chance, I don't remember them having like a grade A scoring chance that was actually on target. They had a couple of good chances that were blocked by Jones and Szoboszlai. But I don't think there was anything in this game where you were like, Chelsea were, you know, dominant. No, I wouldn't say that. I think the XGs kind of weigh it out. Obviously, a penalty is heavily factored into this, but 2.07 to 1.04. 2-1 result. It's about as fair as it gets from the XG standpoint. So really good win for Liverpool. They're unbeaten in their last 10 matches against Chelsea. I don't think that's going to last forever because this is a team, like I said, that appears to be going in the right direction. But a good win nonetheless. And yeah, excited for what's to come.
Absolutely. I got one question for you. Playing a little bit of the title contender, true or false police position here. And listen, I think Slot's been doing a fantastic job with the team that he's inherited from Klopp. Like you said, he's been composed. He's changing the style to be his own. But as far as true test goes for Liverpool, this fares as their like second truest test, right? The first being AC Milan in the Champions League. Obviously, AC is a big club. They're doing well in Serie A. So how much of an increase in confidence or hope is this for the Slot squad for you, given this win? So if you had to rate it of an increase on a scale of 1 to 10, where would you kind of put it?
I think it's kind of exactly where we were before. I think I expect to win most games at home, to be honest. You know, it's a good performance. They beat a Chelsea team that's probably better than I gave them credit for at the beginning of the season. But there's still a lot to be determined. And I think, you know, I had belief that this team could compete for a title, but it comes down to fitness and obviously, you know, results and fixtures to come between Arsenal this weekend, Villa to come, City to come. Obviously having to go and play some away, you know, tough away games as well over the course of the season. So I think Liverpool is probably, I'd say like a 7, and I was probably at a 6.5 before in terms of belief that, you know, that they could win the title. So it doesn't move the needle a ton for me. I think there's better games that'll be a better barometer for that.
Fair. Well, we're at the end of week 8, right? So typically the table tells more truths at 10 and no one really is able to tell anything till after Christmas. So well, there's still a lot of gameplay. Very impressed with both Chelsea and Liverpool. Very impressed with Slot. So there's promise and it's exciting season to come still. A lot of footy left. Well, for the lot of footy that we had this weekend, we get into one of our favorite segments here, which is the rapid kicks. And of course, why don't we launch it to you, Kyle? It is the Man City 2, Wolves 1 rapid kick.
I mean, my God, John Stones, you beautiful bastard. It's not the first time. It won't be the last time. 95th minute, header, goal, 3 points. That's all you got to know. Thank God we didn't lose to the fucking Wolves again.
Yeah, that would have been great. I mean, was it home at the Etihad or is it away at...
It was at Molineux.
Yeah, we always struggle there. We lost there last year on a huge upset. It's just, they get in our head. Pep struggles there every year.
Was the win last year at the Etihad or was it at the Molineux? Molineux, whatever you want.
I think it was away from the Etihad. I think it was at Molineux.
Fair. Well, I was watching that last couple of seconds live, cried, but of course I hedged my emotion with the bet.
Yeah,
so.
The only quick problem with that game is that we have to stop relying on these late winners. We saw this last year in spade, even the 2 years prior with Arsenal. They claimed so many points, and it just shows like it's not reliable. It's not a great way to, you know, get your points, and it hurts you later on in the season having to rely on those.
Yep, you got to put them away, and you got to put them away early. Talking about putting them away early, and the other side of Manchester at this point is the Manchester United 2, Brentford 1. Brentford did what they always do, not within the first 2 minutes for the first time of 4 consecutive English Premier League games, not scoring a goal within the first 2 minutes is relatively impressive. So hats off for Man U for being the first team in 5 games to do that or prevent that. But Manchester United picked up a very much needed win. They stopped their winless slide and come from behind in a 1-0 deficit to win 2-1 against the Bees. So good issue there for Manchester United. They found in the back of the net twice, something that they haven't been able to do at home for most of the season. Can't really say that we saw a positive fluctuation for Manchester United. I think we're going to have to see some consistency from them in order to harp on a little bit more. That's the only reason why we're not diving into them too much more. But Sean, why don't you take us to the next one?
Yeah, another game that concerns top 6 hopefuls. Brighton versus Newcastle. Brighton win 1-0. Danny Welbeck continues his good start to the season with his 5th goal so far. And then Bart Verbruggen made some big saves as the Seagulls soared past the Magpies at St. James's Park, and they entered the top 6 for the first time this season. Kyle, you want to talk about Aston Villa?
I would love to talk about that game. 2 red cards. Each team has a gentleman sent off in that game. It was a great game, though. Aston Villa 3, Fulham 1. Fulham had a really nice early goal with Jimenez, and Aston Villa just fought their way back consistently, played their game 10v10, and they won that 3-1. It's an expected win, I would say, for Aston Villa after such a dominant performance against Bayern Munich, but it's going to hurt Fulham. That was Fulham is a contending team this year for the top half of the table, and this would be a very big surprise, I would say, if they can sneak into European football, and it's got to be against teams like that to do it.
Yep, you got to get the points where you can. Speaking about getting points when you can, it is almost more important when you're in a relegation battle, and we had two of the recently promoted teams, which historically are teams that are also going to be eventually fighting against relegation battle, and we had Leicester 3, Southampton 2 in one of the craziest comebacks for Leicester of the season, probably for any team, really. The Foxes went down 2-0 and looked like they were not the better half for the majority of the game here, but they turned it around and won 3-2 with a second half comeback highlighted by Jordan Ayew's 98th minute winner to move Leicester up to 14th place and 5 points clear from the relegation zone. The games are getting juicy. The teams are starting to all find some form, so it will be a lot more to talk about as the season progresses at the top, middle, and bottom of the table. So everyone better sit down and enjoy it because it's going to be a long-ass ride. But for now, give us a minute break here. We're going to pop into a quick little info session amongst ourselves, and we'll get back to you shortly with the look ahead. All right. More action this weekend, more action during the week, more action during the weekend. I hope we never see another international break. I hope that all the teams just disband and we can just watch the English Premier League uninterrupted for the remainder of my life. But we know that won't happen. So we have to take the time and enjoy each weekend as they arise. And this weekend, we have a couple good show stoppers for us. The first one being Chelsea versus Newcastle at the Stamford Bridge, obviously coming off of that loss against Liverpool away, so they're going to be looking for a bit of a bounce back here. Both teams have aspirations of European tournaments for next season. None of them right now have anything of crucial European importance playing right now. Obviously, Newcastle being the one that had the most to fight for last season, and Chelsea obviously squeaking into the Conference League this season. Sean, what do you think about the matchup initially?
Yeah, I think probably if you asked me a week ago, I would have taken Newcastle to win this game. But, call it recency bias, if you will. I think Chelsea do at home. It's going to be a really tough fixture for Newcastle to win. You know, these teams played three times last year. I think it was two victories for Chelsea and one for Newcastle. Yeah, so it'll be tough. You know, Isak, who was really good in all three games, he scored in all three. He's back. He played his first start since a toe injury against Brighton, but he's still not quite into form yet. So I'd probably edge a little bit towards Chelsea in this one.
Yeah. I'm looking at their home and away forms. Newcastle home and away sit ninth place in the table for both of that. Chelsea at home have only played four times, and they've only seen one win. They've seen two draws and a loss, so let's see if they can get a little bit of momentum going at the Stamford Bridge. I think, you know, from the beginning of the season, I was a little bit high on Chelsea, especially after their game against Manchester City, so I don't think this is going to be a walk in the park for either team, especially with Newcastle finding a bit of good form. Of course, Alexander Isak has been holding out in conversations of renewing or extending his contract, so I wonder what type of form we're going to see for him until that is all figured out. Teams like Arsenal are on high alert for that with his agents. So I'll be very interested to see if he can find some form and stay healthy as well. But I think this will be a very interesting game. I think Chelsea will edge them out, Newcastle, that is. I just think that Chelsea have so many attacking options and they can go so late into the games with the depth of their squad that it's going to be a challenge for Newcastle. But that's my take on it. A question I know we asked Kyle right before he popped off here, but for you, Sean, and for myself, assuming that the Premier League gets five Champions League spots next year, who do you see in those spots? And we'll start with fourth place.
Yeah, I think it will be Chelsea and then Villa.
Kyle gave us Spurs. And then for me in fourth place, I think I have to go with it's going to be Villa, then Spurs. and then Chelsea. I think Chelsea and Spurs are going to be fighting the hardest. I think Villa will be able to find the form as they have. I think the only thing that's going against Villa is the fact that they are in the Champions League. So if they go on a deep run, that is going to cause some issues. So there's a little asterisk on that one for me. It's going to be very difficult, I think, between the three, Villa, Chelsea, and Spurs.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, of course, the game that we have all been waiting for every season, it happens twice a season, sometimes three times, but it is Arsenal versus Liverpool. This one happens to be at Emirates Stadium. This one, we were talking about toughest tests before for Liverpool. This has got to be their toughest test of the season thus far and would be one of their toughest seasons for the remainder of the season, Sean. How do you feel?
Yeah, I think obviously the absence of Saliba is a crucial point for a Liverpool perspective. Obviously, we're not without injuries either. Alisson is obviously ruled out for this one with a torn hamstring, and then Jota is probably going to miss. He was subbed off against Chelsea in the 29th minute. I think it was a rib injury, and he did not travel with the team to Leipzig. So the odds of him, you know, turning around and starting against a team that he, you know, has to typically scored quite a bit against are pretty low. I think this game's overall, though, I have, you know, relatively strong, good feeling going into it. But no, I understand that this is a very well-coached team and a very talented team, particularly if Saka's back. I think it'll be neck and neck, even game. If he doesn't play, I would say we have the advantage. But obviously, going into Emirates, it's not an easy place to play or to win a game by any means.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing for me, obviously, Diogo Jota, if he's not able to play, is an absolute menace against Arsenal consistently every season. I love the guy and I hate him at the same time because you have to respect his game, but I hate him with a deep burning passion when he plays against Arsenal because he always seems to net a goal in against us. So a little perk there on the injury list, but pointing out the Saka injury, if he's not able to play, if he's not able to actually play at his full capacity, I think that it's even worse than him playing at 50% capacity because he's just not going to be the threat that we need to emphasis on. He won't be as much as distracting with it. But in the beginning of the season, I think in the preview, I said our most important player is not one, it's two players. We wouldn't have an issue if one or the other was missing, but missing both at the same time is huge. And that's Odegaard still obviously being out. I don't think he'll be returning for this game or possibly a game in November. And then Saka, obviously having the both of them gone is a major blow to this Arsenal squad. And then you put in the loss of potentially our third best player, which is Saliba, and you have a totally different squad. So I am nervous for this one for sure. Being home gives me a little bit more hope, but the three core players, we just can't seem to have a critical game with all of our lads, which is unfortunate. So obviously we won this fixture last year 3-1, which kicked off an incredible run for Arsenal, and they won 7 of 8 games after that with an aggregate score of 28-2. Within that run, I believe we had scored 2 goals in each consecutive first and second half for, I think, 7 or 6 halves of soccer, which was really impressive. But obviously, I think this one is definitely going to be a much larger issue.
Yeah, for sure. And I wanted to talk about it just because you just touched upon his absence. What does your ideal back four look like for this game? Obviously, Timber's also a guy who's got some injuries at the moment as well. So that could throw a wrench into your ideal scenario, who's available and who's not in the back four. But what does it look like for you? I can tell you what I think, but I want to hear your perspective first.
Yeah, it's really tough. Unfortunately, today too, I think it was just a slight knock. We have the possibility of now Calafiori picked something up against the Champions League game today. With that out of my mind, my ideal back four looks exactly what yours looks like as well. It's a Timber at right back, it's Calafiori at the left back, and you have the pairing of White and Gabriel. White and Gabriel, before Saliba came back from his loan spell, that's kind of what kicked off the defensive prowess that was Arsenal getting their feet underneath them again. So I think that pairing is very, very good. If you had to swap and Calafiori is healthy, instead of having someone invert, I think Calafiori could play a very more forward-thinking center back, and you could put White on the right side. You could do the pairing of Calafiori and Gabriel, and you could put Timber on the left side, but it's all depending on who's healthy. As long as we don't have the trio of Rice, Mourinho, and Partey as three center defensive mids again, I think we'll be doing better. But obviously some major ifs and or buts with our potential lineups. To me, that really, you know, going back to the Bournemouth game, the selection also kind of was a big issue with me with those three players that we just mentioned with Partey, Rice, and Mourinho. To me, you got to have more like for like. So we had a like for like with Sterling playing on the right side for Saka, who was injured, who will most likely probably happen again. You have Martinelli on the left side. You have Kai Havertz. I see us kind of reverting to more of a 4-4-2 format, which is what we've done against Spurs when we were down without Rice and Udegaard, and then against what we did with PSG. And it worked out very well. We had Kai Havertz and Trossard up top. And Trossard played a little bit more of a false nine behind Kai, who had freedom as almost a 9/10. And I think that's something that we should have done against Bournemouth. And I think that's something we're going to have to do against Liverpool. Last thing, and then it's all you. If I see Thomas Partey at right back, I will throw any round and or sharp object near me very hard, hopefully through a wall, to hit somebody. An innocent bystander, I don't care. Thomas Partey will not get the job done at right back against a healthy Luis Diaz. It's just going to destroy him. He's going to destroy Thomas Partey, and then we're just going to have another injury on our hands because he will not leave this game with two ankles. He will leave with zero and sprains, and it will be bloodbath on that left side if Luis Diaz gets the start on that side and Thomas Partey gets that start. So that's the only thing that I don't want to see this weekend.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very interesting point. And obviously, I think 2 years ago at this game at the Emirates, Diaz got hurt in the game and basically was out for a long stretch of time, like maybe 3 or 4 months. So if we do get to see that matchup, hopefully he can exact a little bit of revenge. Obviously, I know you don't hope so, but yeah. I certainly do. From a tactical standpoint from Liverpool, I would like to see Curtis Jones play again in this game. I thought he was excellent against Chelsea beyond the goals. He still has that problem where he holds the ball a little bit too long. The goal to Gakpo that was chalked off for offsides, if he plays Salah in a half second earlier, it's a goal. And then the same thing on the second penalty that he drew and then was overturned. It's just like, dude, what are you waiting for? Just take it. Like, just be a little bit more deliberate in your actions. And I think we have a phenomenal player there. But I would like to see him in a double pivot with Gravenberch. I think his athleticism and his size, his ball control, ability to dribble through what is a very, very strong Arsenal mid block, is valuable. And then McAllister in the 10, we haven't seen it yet, but I just haven't loved what I've seen from Szoboszlai of late. I think he's been a little bit too sloppy, and when the levels are this high, I expect it's got to be better. So I would like to see McAllister in that role. I think be interesting to kind of see. I know obviously Szoboszlai leads the press, but make some adjustments there, particularly if Nunez is playing in this game. I thought his overall game, he's about played as well as you can without, you know, being involved in a scoring chance in terms of, you know, his shot. He should have had an assist if Curtis Jones just shot one last week. He also had some really good defensive work. So I thought I was watching Bobby Firmino in a 6'3" guy's body. It was insane. Yeah, I was so happy. So, you know, if Jota is unable to play, I think, you know, Nunez is in pretty good form and kind of allows you to make a little bit of tweak. So I'd like to see McAllister and Jones alongside Gravenberch in that midfield. But yeah, it'll be a good one for sure. Bummed that we won't be able to watch this one together, but the wife could pop at any minute, so I have to kind of be at her side.
Yeah, that makes sense. I won't hold it against you. In terms of Nunez, interesting, and to me, this is probably a perfect game for Nunez because it's going to be a center-back pairing that hasn't played together in the season so far. So I think running chaos Nunez would be a prime chaotic kind of wrench in that defensive line. So I think that would be great. Do you have a score line or a prediction for this one before we move on?
I think it's got to be low scoring. I'm probably going to go 1-0 to Liverpool.
Yeah, I think I go 1-1, but I pessimistically just think we have too many things to overcome against a Liverpool side that's clicking, and I think Liverpool could walk away 1-0 on this one. Yeah. Well, that's sad. That hurts. But anyway, segment number 5, let's just move on with it, I guess, is the Fantasy Premier League roundup and the player to watch for. So Sean, why don't you, this is your week to bless us with your thought process. So let's go.
Yeah. So we'll start it off with a little bit of update on the standings. Graham Hewitt, again, stands atop, I think we talk about him more than we talk about Salah, Saka, and Phil Foden combined. He is undefeated. He eked out a one-point win 2 weeks ago and now a three-point win this past week. Someone stop this man, please. Someone do it. Sick of talking about his undefeated record.
Yep.
I know he's a Liverpool fan, but he bought a United jersey, and that still doesn't vibe with me. With our money. With our money went to buying a United jersey. Our good friend Kyle is 1-7. It's a shame he's not on the podcast now to discuss his abhorrent performance. It really is upsetting to just even look at in the standings. But he did win a game. We didn't talk about that. He did win a game, so congratulations. He did lose to podcast nemesis Ian this past week in the highest scoring matchup of the week by far. Myself, I'm sitting at 6-2, just outside of European football in sixth place. And then you, my friend, you are 5-3. You are also in that top half mix. Pretty good start for the two of us. Our co-host, better left unsaid. From my fantasy player of the week perspective, I can't believe I'm saying it, but I think if you have Eberechi Eze in your lineup, you have to drop him. Palace are a shambles at the moment. And the guy I would pick up is Dejan Kulusevski. I talked about him earlier when we were breaking down Tottenham. He's been in great form. He's got 2 goals and an assist since Ange started to use him more as a midfielder. And he saved you a little bit of money at 500K cheaper than Eze. So for those of you who are going to say, wow, this guy Sean, he's an idiot. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Who told you to pick up Ryan Mbeumo? I told you to do that. He's got goals in 4 straight games. So chew on that one.
I got to say, the switch up from lock of the week to fantasy Premier League advice, it's been a 180. We've kind of been killing it lately. The previous podcast, we told you to pick up Rodgers. What has he been doing? He's killing it. He just hit his stride. So, you know, you might want to listen to these guys a little bit here. Of course, I didn't listen to my own advice, and I used a wild card this week, and I completely destroyed my team. That was doing fine. So I'm going to cry for a little bit, and hopefully it gets turned around with the next couple runnings of games. But, hey, it just brings more excitement when you have individual players to root for. Definitely, if you haven't checked it out, check out our league. You can't join right now, but you can mark on your calendars for next season to join. We've gone up by multiple numbers from year to year with our highest right now. I think we're sitting at 44 or 48 participants, which is great. So we're looking to get that even better. And again, the winner of this year, just like last year, will get on our dime a jersey of their choice for next season. So without further ado, this concludes our episode for the week. I will cry a little bit more at the end of it. But Sean, always a pleasure to be with you, sir. Keep me posted. Keep us all posted in the world of parenting. And the best of luck to everybody.
Thank you, sir.
Of course. Well, until next time, everybody, enjoy the rest of your week.